Welcome to Politics and Reality Radio. I'm Joshua Holland. This week, now that it appears that healthcare reform is dead, and Republicans are going to shift their attention to tax reform, we're going to talk to Stan Collender. Stan is the budget guy. He's a columnist at Forbes. And then we're going to be joined by Lindsay Beierstein. Lindsay and I are going to just talk about what a remarkable week in Trumpism we've had. It was interesting, to say the least. And finally, we're going to be joined by Nevada Assemblyman Mike Sprinkle. Mike introduced a bill for Medicaid for all, not Medicare for all, but Medicaid for all. It was vetoed by the Republican governor. He is going to reintroduce it. Other states are looking at it. In the age of unified Republican control of the federal government, it may be a model for expanding health care at the state level for innovative, forward-leaning states. And we'll talk about that. We don't have a lot of time for an introduction, so we're going to take a quick break and then jump right into the show. Musical theme this week is summertime songs. Back. I'm still Joshua Holland, and I'm joined now by our go-to budget wonk, Stan Collender. Stan writes a column for Forbes, and he's a vice president of Corvus MSL Group, whatever that is. And you should follow him on Twitter for sure, for all things budgetary, and also because he's a good guy to follow on Twitter in general. His handle is @TheBudgetGuy, all one word. Stan, welcome back to Politics and Reality Radio.
Thank you. It's always good to be in to try to put a little reality into the discussion, especially these days.
With all the politics, you got to inject some reality. So it looks like Republican efforts to repeal and maybe replace the Affordable Care Act are dead for the moment. Stan wrote a column this week about how the effort is still alive procedurally, but there doesn't seem to be a lot of political will to rehash that at any time soon. So now it looks like we're moving on to tax reform and other fiscal stuff. We have a budget, there's a debt limit. So let's get our wonk on. Stan, set us up with the kind of landscape here. If Republicans hope to pass huge high-end tax cuts, without Senate Democrats filibustering. They need a new budget resolution. And again, there's also the debt limit coming. How hard do you think this is all going to be?
Well, it's going to make healthcare reform look like a walk in the park. And needless to say, that was a bitter fight within the Republican Party. There are multiple, maybe many multiples of bitter fights within the Republican Party that are coming forward and are going to come to the forefront. For example, the biggest question that the Republicans will have to face is, should this be deficit neutral? That is, should whatever new system they come up with raise the same amount of revenue as the existing system? Well, that's a difficult thing to do, since what you want to do is give a lot of tax cuts. And that means, and if you want to keep it revenue neutral, it means you've got to come up with tax increases someplace else. So that's going to be a huge fight, with the House fighting the Senate, with Senate Republicans fighting other Senate Republicans. It's not clear they're going to be able to figure that one out, at least not anytime soon.
And the debt limit shouldn't be hard, but Republicans have told their base, and who knows, maybe they've told themselves, that raising the debt limit increases spending. So it's, and by the way, that is nonsense. It's about paying bills that Congress has already authorized. But that has made it a fraught vote for Republicans. During the Obama years, then Speaker John Boehner would give the Dems just enough votes to increase the limit, but it was mostly Dems who did the heavy lifting. Do you think that's going to change now that Republicans have unified control of government and will own any kind of fallout from playing debt limit shenanigans? Or are they still going to expect Democrats to provide a bunch of votes for this?
Well, I know they don't want to have Democrats provide a lot of votes. It is not clear the Democrats will do it without extracting a great deal of what they want. That is, Democrats won't vote for this unless there's some additional things on the Democratic agenda that get included in the bill. But this is really more, before you even get to Democrats, this is going to be another Republican versus Republican fight. You've got some folks, including Secretary of Treasury Mnuchin, who want what they call a clean debt ceiling bill with nothing attached to it. No policy riders, no spending cuts, no tax cuts, no nothing, just straight out increase the debt ceiling. There are others, particularly in the House Freedom Caucus, the uber conservatives, who are saying no way, no how, we're not voting for a debt ceiling increase without a variety of things being attached to it. That is, it'll be a clean debt ceiling over our dead body. Now, here's the interesting thing. First of all, the Freedom Caucus has enough votes to stop this dead in its tracks in the House. That is, there are 40 or so House Freedom Caucus members who, if they vote against this, will deny the Republican leadership enough votes to get anything passed in the House on a debt ceiling. Second, a former member of the House Freedom Caucus, Mick Mulvaney, former congressman from South Carolina, is now the director of the Office of Management and Budget, and in spite of the fact that Mnuchin nominally is in charge of the debt ceiling fight, has been arguing within the White House that there should be something attached to it. That is, it shouldn't be clean. So this is going to be a White House versus Congress, House Republicans versus Senate Republicans, and maybe House Republicans versus other House Republicans fight. And notice that I didn't say the Democrats in there. The Democrats will only be the fallback position if the leadership can't get anything done.
You know, I wonder if we should add Republican overreach to death and taxes. So the only sure things in life are death, taxes, and Republican overreach. And I am referring to the Freedom Caucus. They are going to demand the world here. And these hardliners, by the way, they have been a huge pain in the butt for Republican leaders. Going back to John Boehner, they make these maximal right-wing demands on everything, and then they say, "Oh well, we won't vote for it if we don't get our way." So the rule of thumb on the Hill is that moderates always cave. You have to assuage the right-wingers, because the more reasonable Republicans can be, I don't know, bought off with some goodies or perhaps intimidated by the base. But Stan, last week, Rachel Bade reported for Politico, I don't know if you saw this piece, and I quote, she said, "Some in the centrist Tuesday group," these are the moderates, "have started to adopt the power in number strategy of the Freedom Caucus." So Bade says that moderates are looking at these Freedom Caucus people and saying, wait a second, if we get together, we can be pains in the butt too. Let me ask you this. First of all, is this something you're seeing as somebody who's, you know, more connected than I am?
Oh, yeah, definitely. You look up until this year, the Tuesday group, the moderate Republicans, were afraid to even look at their shadow for fear that someone might run against their shadow in a primary. The fear of the Freedom Caucus doing that isn't as great right now. They're in districts that are much more protected than they've been in the past, or their ability to raise money is much greater. So there's less political fear by the moderate Republicans and a realization that, you know what, we've probably got as many votes as the Freedom Caucus does. Why don't we play the same game? So it's definitely there. But can we go back one step here? You mentioned the words John Boehner. Let's remember, he essentially got thrown out by the Freedom Caucus, that is threatened with political emasculation or no confidence vote by the Freedom Caucus, because he worked with Democrats on a variety of bills. Now, think of what we were just saying. That is, if the Republicans can't get their act together, if they're overreaching, in your words, then they're going to have to work with Democrats. That is, Paul Ryan is going to have to go to the Nancy Pelosi and say, what would it take to get you to vote for a debt ceiling? That could create another leadership crisis in the House among Republicans. Just what we need in Washington right now is another crisis of leadership.
Right. There's not enough chaos on the other side of Pennsylvania Avenue, right? I mean, everything's so stable and predictable in the White House. You need a little chaos on the Hill as well. I've been saying that they should, the Democrats should offer votes, should offer conditions. And the one that's very obvious to me is these cost-sharing reductions that are in dispute. They are basically payments that reimburse insurance companies for giving low-income Obamacare enrollees a break on their out-of-pocket costs. Do you think that this is something that the Democrats would do?
I think that might very well be one of their positions, but I don't think they're going to take it publicly. As soon as you announce it publicly, you get Republicans with their nose out of joint, their backs up, and you actually harden positions. My guess would be my recommendation to the Democrats would be, let the Republicans come to you. Let them fail to get the votes that they need among their own caucus, and be desperate and have to come to you rather than leading with an opening position like that. I think it's the right thing to do, but it's the right policy choice to make. I just would change the tactic a little bit of how you get there.
Okay. If you're just tuning in, I'm Joshua Holland, and I'm speaking with Stan Collender, the budget guy. Shifting to tax reform, I want to run a couple of news stories by you. The Daily Beast reported that Trump's new chief of staff, John Kelly, has been working the phones, calling Democrats. This signals, and I quote, a newfound openness to working with congressional Democrats, or at least to alleviating some of the toxic partisan differences that have marked their tenure. Then Politico reported that 45 Senate Democrats sent a letter to congressional leaders and to the White House saying they'd work on bipartisan tax reforms if they met a few conditions. Those conditions were no cuts for the richest, no tax cuts financed through deficit spending, and do it all in normal order, meaning that they need to come up with something that gets 60 votes in the Senate instead of 51. So I'm a deeply cynical person, and when I read this stuff, it might as well be an article about unicorns, because I'm looking at an intensely polarized Congress. But then again, maybe I'm wrong, because, you know, with the healthcare fiasco in their rearview mirror, and with Trump's absolute desperation for some kind of win, maybe these factors could knock some bipartisanship loose. I wonder what your thoughts are.
Well, I mean, first of all, John Kelly does have some congressional liaison background. He did that for the Marine Corps for years. So he understands the way the world works a little bit better than us, you know, than the Mooch did, certainly, and probably Reese Priebus. But he's only been in office for 24 hours. He dealt with, a variety of issues yesterday. I doubt he's had much time to make lots of calls to Democrats. Maybe a courtesy call to Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer, but not much more than that. Maybe that's coming, maybe it's not. You got to look at the Democrats' notification, the story in Politico about what they would want to begin negotiations, as just the very beginning of a discussion. The Republicans would never agree to all of those things. I'm not sure the Democrats would really want all of those things, but they're just setting it up, saying, look, we know you want bipartisanship because it's the only way you're going to get tax reform anytime soon. Here's what you have to do to get us. And now they're going to wait for a you know, the Republicans to come back with their own offer, just to get them to the table. But look at that that Democrat offer as more as a play to their base than as a real negotiating tool with the Republicans on tax reform.
And is it true that they can't get tax reform done without Democratic votes? I mean, how much can they do through reconciliation?
Well, tax reform is a little different than health care. Health care has a variety of provisions in it that don't have any impact on the budget and therefore would be violating what's called the Byrd Rule and would be removed from a reconciliation bill. The tax reform bill, for the most part, 99.9% of it, would have budget impacts, would be directly related to the federal budget bottom line, and therefore would qualify. So they could do more under reconciliation than they could do with health care. But it's not clear to me that they're going to be even able to get a budget resolution to get to reconciliation. Today, Orrin Hatch came out and said, we want to do this through regular order. I read that as saying, well, we know we don't have the votes for a budget resolution, so let's go to Plan B.
And what's the likelihood? So, okay, we've talked about all of their challenges. Conservatives asking for too much in terms of cuts. Let's say they don't succeed with all of these fiscal acrobatics. Let's say they don't come up with a budget resolution to go ahead with reconciliation and even tackle tax reform. What does failure look like? Is it just continuing resolutions to keep the government open and the Republicans swallow another loss?
It's going to be worse than that, actually. It's not just Republicans swallowing a loss. Remember, the president proposed, and John McCain and other senators insisted, that Congress appropriate more money for defense, $54 to $60 billion more for defense than they're allowed to under the existing law. There are caps on defense, and that would prevent the president from getting, and McCain getting the increase he wants. So failure in this case, no budget, no reconciliation, would mean A, you just continue the same spending priorities that exist right now, and that means no big defense increase. Second, you'd continue defense subject to a sequester, which the Defense Department is adamantly against. Third, no tax reform. So this would be, and by the way, and then no stimulus, no fiscal stimulus of any kind this year. No tax cuts, no infrastructure financing, no more for defense. So the president couldn't get to his 3% growth rate that he's been promising, and that almost certainly means the deficit will be higher, much higher than anyone had anticipated, maybe $1 trillion a year by within 10 years. So
wow.
this would be not just a failure, this would be a total and abject failure.
A disaster. And of course, no wall. How much can they sneak into? So just to remind listeners, we have this sequester. It caps military spending along with non-defense discretionary spending. How much military spending can they sneak in through these contingency funds, which is how they've been doing it in the recent past?
All right. Well, just to explain to everybody, back for the Afghan and Iraqi war, the Congress set up what's known as the Overseas Contingency Operations Fund, essentially an off-budget item. That is, it doesn't count against the spending cap. So they could spend, they could appropriate, they being Congress, could appropriate all the money that the president wants, $60 billion in OCO, or the Overseas Contingency Operations Fund, and without violating the caps. That might be one way around it, actually. But that would take 60 votes to do that, and it's not clear Democrats would get them to go along.
Stan, thank you so much for giving us this whole rundown. I really do appreciate it. It's gonna be really intense political theater. Let me ask you one other question before I let you go. We saw a lot of resistance, like great resistance to the healthcare thing, and I know this is a little bit outside of your bailiwick, but do you think that there will be things in these budget proposals that will potentially inspire the same kind of resistance? In other words, are they going to have things that are like, wow, this is a whopping cut to Medicaid that open people's eyes and say, we got to get into these lawmakers' faces? Or is this all going to be so stealthy and wonky and hard to understand that it does not kind of inspire the same kind of blowback?
It's a real good question. It depends on whether, the whole issue depends on whether or not Congress decides that this is going to be revenue neutral. If they think if it's going to be revenue neutral, then for every tax cut that you put in tax reform, there's going to have to be a tax increase or some credit or deduction that goes away. Let me get and that's going to generate huge opposition. I mean, going to make what happened in healthcare look like a picnic. Let me give you an example. I don't think this is going to happen, but as an example, suppose in order to pay for some of the tax cuts they want, Congress decides to do away with the mortgage interest deduction. Then every homeowner, I mean, every single one, every real estate agent, every mortgage banker, every contractor is going to be lobbying. I mean, there'll be pitchforks in the streets in Washington. That's how bad it's going to get. Now, there are not every tax deduction and credit is as politically powerful as that one, but for every one that they try to get rid of, for every deduction and credit they try to eliminate, there will be massive political opposition.
One person's, you know, wasted loophole is another person's, thank God I have this tax credit. Stan, I want to thank you so much. I believe we're out of time. I really do appreciate it.
Sure. Take care.
Folks, stay tuned. We're going to take a quick break and then come right back.
Try and earn a dollar. Every time I call my baby to try to get a date, my boss says, no dice, son, you gotta work late. Sometimes I wonder what I'm gonna do, cause there ain't no cure for the summertime blues. Well, my mom and papa told me, son, you gotta make some money. If you wanna use a car to go riding next Sunday. Well, I didn't go to work, told the boss I was sick. Now you can't use a car cause you didn't work a lick. Sometimes I wonder what I'm gonna do, cause there ain't no cure for the summertime blues. I'm gonna take my problem to the United Nations. Well, I called the congressman and he said, quote, I'd like to help you, son, but you're too young to vote. Sometimes I wonder what I'm gonna do, cause there ain't no cure for the summertime blues.
Welcome back to the show. We haven't spoken to Lindsay Beierstein for a while, and that's always a mistake, so I'm happy to have her back on this week's show. Lindsay's writing appears pretty much everywhere. She also hosts the Breach podcast, which you can find at Rewire News or wherever podcasts are sold. Lindsay, welcome back to Politics and Reality Radio.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for taking the time. So I want to talk Trump with you this week because there's so much happening with the chaos monkey right now. And I figured we'd catch up before what may be a lull. Trump's going on vacation for 17 days to rest up after achieving so many, historically bad polls.
So many epic golf trips.
But before we dig into that, I think I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you about this short film you produced with Martina Starosta that came out in June. Congratulations on that. Tell us a little bit about Care and Chaos.
Sure. It's the story of two abortion clinics, one in Fargo, North Dakota, and one in Charlotte, North Carolina. And it's kind of the best of times, worst of times for two red state clinics with active protester presences. They both have a ton of protesters, but in Fargo, the rule of law prevails because they have a solid community policing model. And in North Carolina, it is just absolutely chaotic. And the protesters are wandering in front of people's cars, sticking their hands in open windows, just kind of acting like they own the place, bombarding a clinic with sound, amplified sound, sometimes over 100 decibels, which is the equivalent exposure of operating a jackhammer with no headphones if you're 10 feet away from it. And So we follow the clinic administrator, Calla Hales, who was only 26 when we filmed. She's since had a birthday, but she heads up a chain of 4 abortion clinics in the South for her family, who've been in the abortion care business for now. Now they're on their second generation. And we just follow her struggles to try and get some responsiveness out of local law enforcement, who are just inept at best and indifferent, if not hostile at worst.
And this film, it's a short film. I encourage everybody to check it out. It is maddening. I mean, some of the scenes in North Carolina made my blood boil, because it's like, these people are literally like, I mean, you know, I don't want to overstate, but they're terrorists. They are terrifying people who are seeking health care. And it's just so, it's so frustrating that this is a lawful enterprise and they can't get law enforcement to control the situation. It's completely out of control. Where can listeners check it out?
They can find it on rewire.news, the website. So, and it's called Care and Chaos, or if you just Google Care and Chaos, it should pop right up.
Yeah, and if you Google it, it's also on like YouTube or all of those,
Vimeo. I think we have a Vimeo page.
Yeah, Vimeo. And listeners should check it out, just so you know what's going on. Okay, let's talk about our knucklehead in chief. The White House is absolutely obsessed with leaks, and for good reason. I mean, it has certainly undermined his presidency and contributed to his now 37% approval rating, according to the 538 average. So of course somebody goes and leaks these phone conversations that Trump had in the first week of his presidency with his counterparts in Mexico and in Australia. And by the way, I've been trying to coin this neologism, hilarifying, right? This is, if this were a fictional TV show, you know, or Alec Baldwin on Saturday Night Live, it's funny. It's objectively funny. But then it's terrifying that the president of the United States is just as buffoonish and self-aggrandizing and kind of dense during high-level calls with world leaders as he is during public appearances. So what was your takeaway from his call with Peña Nieto, Mexico's conservative president? Can you just set it up for a bit for listeners who didn't catch this?
So this is, I think, about 4 days after he's inaugurated, and he gets on the phone with Enrique Peña Nieto, who's Mexico's president, and starts talking about, it's just clear that he doesn't know anything about the status quo ex ante about trade relations between the U.S. and Mexico, or what a trade deficit really is, or whether it's good or bad. He's raging at Nieto's, at Peña, saying, you know, he's rattling off, you know, $60 billion trade deficit or whatever it is, and which, you know, the New York Times annotated as saying, most economists think this is excellent and inevitable when two countries merge their economies to the degree that the U.S. and Mexico have. So you can just see Peña kind of trying to come to grips with the fact that that Trump really has no idea what he's talking about. And of course, the most striking thing for me about that call was Trump basically ordering Peña to lie about the status of negotiations with the border wall. He's saying, you must not say that Mexico won't pay for the wall. You must say that we're still working on the wall, paying for the wall. And it's just mind-boggling and sad. It's just Donald Trump coming up against Mexico is like, you know nothing at all about Mexico, do you, sir? It's all Cancun and tequila for you. You have no idea about Mexico's national pride and dignity and how Peña's political future depends on his ability to be strong and not in any way countenance the idea that that Mexico would ever pay a dime towards the wall. And I also feel like Peña's kind of our stand-in for the American people, all the people of the Americas, as we all just kind of collectively realize, oh my God, this isn't an act. This isn't a bluff. This is really him.
Now, I think, I'm not sure that this is right, but I believe that Peña Nieto is a is an economist that was trained at like Harvard or something like that. I believe I may be mixing up my biographies, but he's certainly a guy who knows what he's talking about, unlike the commander in chief. And I also like the way that he just casually said that he had won New Hampshire when he had in fact lost New Hampshire.
He won New Hampshire because it's a drug infested den.
I've never seen a more wretched hive of scum and villainy. And of course his supporters won't care. They're like, yeah, okay, it's a drug infested den. He's just telling it like it is. So then he has this call with Australian PM Malcolm Turnbull. And the remarkable thing was just how dense he appeared to be. Did you get the sense that when he was told over and over again about this refugee deal and just could not grasp what he was being told? Like it was remarkable. Jonathan Shade at New York Magazine said, there's this moment when it's clear that Turnbull realizes he's just a complete idiot.
Yeah, or he just cannot get it through with Trump, just cannot get it through his head that Turnbull is not accepting these refugees, not because they're criminals, not because they're deviants, but because they came by boat. And the reason Turnbull explains very carefully that they're keeping out people who came by boat is that they don't want to create an economy in which human smugglers can flourish. That these might be perfectly excellent refugees and great prospective Australians, but they can't just keep creating a market for people to charge money to get ferried across the water in super dangerous ways. So they're just taking a really hard line, which is why Australia wanted the U.S. to take the initiative and, you know, or live up to its prior commitment and screen these people for U.S. immigration purposes and see if any of them could be safe to bring into the U.S. But Trump just is not having it. He does not understand why would you discriminate against folks, he says.
He says it. But the thing is that I believe Turnbull explains it four separate times. Four separate times. And he says, and Trump keeps going, they're in prison. They wouldn't be in prison if they weren't bad people. And then finally at the end, towards the end, he goes, they came by boat?
Is that why? And then there's that bizarre line where it's like, they're really bad. They're not going to get a job and work for the local milk people. And I was going for a second the local milk people meant the Nazis, because there's that huge vogue of Nazis drinking milk, you know, the Richard Spencer icon of the milk glass. But I don't think that was it. I think it just plain doesn't make sense.
I think he was – I don't know what he was talking about. I think he meant – that they wouldn't be working in agriculture, like, right?
That's or something. They wouldn't get good, you know, good blue collar jobs driving milk trucks.
It's just really embarrassing to be an American right now. It's just embarrassing.
I mean, in fairness to Trump, everybody seems kind of dumb when you play back an exact verbatim transcript of their remarks. But
well, wait a second. Is that true when you're talking about? Is that true when you're talking about world leaders? I don't believe it is. I don't think that if you played back the typical recorded conversation of an Obama or, you know, Macron.
No, world leaders prepare really carefully for these things.
Yeah.
So they make sure that what comes out verbatim actually sounds good being read back. It's an exhaustive process. It's a performance. But Trump refuses to do any of that work. So, of course, it sounds like he's ad-libbing it because he is.
And that's a really good point, because at the time we heard a lot of reports about how his staff was trying to get him to prepare for these calls and he refused to do so. So you're right. Even if you're a smart person, generally you do a bunch of research beforehand. You're briefed by various agency heads about what's going on, and you don't come off sounding like you're Donald Trump. Ugh. If you're just tuning in, this is Politics and Reality Radio, and I'm speaking with Lindsay Byerstein. Lindsay, on a more serious note, it appears that former FBI Director Robert Mueller's probe is really gathering steam. Just this Thursday, Robert Mueller, the Wall Street Journal reported that Robert Mueller had impaneled a second grand jury. This is in addition to the grand jury in Virginia that was looking into Michael Flynn, Trump's former national security advisor. So this is a second one in Washington, D.C. Then Reuters reported that subpoenas have been issued about that June 16 meeting where Trump Jr. and Paul Manafort and Jared Kushner had met with that Russian lawyer. Murray Wass reported for Vox that all of these senior FBI officials have been informed that they should prepare to testify. So he says, look, it's not going to be Comey's word versus Trump's word. It's going to be one senior FBI official after another. And it's, and he says, look, this is going to be the collusion case, the obstruction case against Trump is a lot stronger than people think. And then,
but what's in the public record is pretty strong too. I mean, considering that he admitted, or you know, that his aides leaked the admission that he drafted Don Jr.'s statement, his very own self, and then they confirmed it, I believe.
Yeah, they did.
Externally.
I mean, they keep confirming things that they should deny. They really, it's a remarkable trend with this White House. I mean, remember that the communication staff was saying that, you know, Trump did not fire Comey over Russia at all. And then Trump went and did an interview with Lester Holt and said, yeah, it was because of Russia.
Yep, the Russia thing.
This has just been happening again and again and again. And then Trump said that if Mueller... if his probe went beyond the narrow issue of potential collusion with the Russians, he would be crossing a red line. And CNN reported this week that Mueller, of course, just shot right past that line and is kind of following the money. And this is now an expansive investigation into Trump and his associates' business dealings. Can he survive that kind of thing?
I guess it's, I mean, one thing I was found really heartening was that the senators voted unanimously to prevent him from making any recess appointments, which would throw, make it much more difficult for him to, say, get rid of Sessions and fire Mueller, and then, you know, or get rid of Sessions, replace Sessions with someone pliable who would then proceed to fire Mueller. And then a bunch of different Republican senators and Democratic senators are introducing legislation that would make it more difficult in other ways for him to get rid of Mueller. So that's a really encouraging thing. And just the fact that Mueller's grand juries are now totally public makes it politically more difficult for Trump to do anything to thwart Mueller. But, I mean, I guess we'll have to wait and see whether the Republican senators who would be, you know, who could remove him from office. I mean, the Democrats have a pretty good chance of retaking the House in 2018. So, you know, if Mueller's inquiry proceeds on the same brisk schedule that we've been seeing, there could be some really meaty indictments and stuff for people to be mulling over when the Dems retake the House. I'm not super optimistic that they're going to retake the Senate because of the way the map looks, but
yeah, no, that's a really, really tall order, and I'm not even that sanguine about the House just because of, you know, the combination of gerrymandering and inefficient distribution of Dem votes means that they need to win the popular vote by about 8 points. They're polling about that right now, but you never know what's going to happen. But it does look like Robert Mueller's schedule, and we don't know exactly the timetable, right? But there have been a number of reports that say, yeah, this is probably going to go on for about 6 more months. And if you think about it, we're in August, 6 more months. Now you're talking about 10 months before the midterm elections. We may start to actually have some indictments, perhaps, maybe a report. It's unclear what exactly he's going to produce. There's this narrative that Democrats and some of us on the left are overhyping the Russia thing. Do you think it's possible that we're underestimating the degree of trouble that Trump and his kind of circle might find themselves in? The reason that I ask is that you know, I'm a New Yorker, and I've known this guy as a corrupt, mobbed-up kind of ripoff artist since forever. But he's never had
this... He built Trump Tower out of concrete because he controlled the mobbed-up unions at the time. Like, that every time you look at Trump Tower, it should be a testament to the strength of Donald Trump's connections to the mafia going back 30 years.
Yeah. But he's never had this kind of scrutiny or anything even approaching it.
Yeah, so I think that now that Mueller has decided to go deep and look at his business connections, the sky is really the limit in terms of the amount of stuff that could be dug up on Trump. Some involving Russia, some involving possibly other nefarious actors. We'll just have to wait and see. It's pretty exciting, though.
I think you're right, and it is kind of exciting. It's frightening, but kind of exciting at the same time.
What a time to be alive.
Yeah, well, you know, there's that Russian, what is it, Chinese proverb, you know, may you live in interesting times. It's not, nobody's sure if it's a blessing or a curse. Lindsay, I believe we're about out of time. Before I let you go, what's going on the breach this week?
On the breach this week, we are going to be talking to Pam Merritt of NARAL about the anti-choice turn in certain key Democratic rhetoric this week and what that might bode for the Democrats' stance on choice going into the midterms.
Boo, Democrats. Boo. Lindsay, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me this week. I really do appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me.
Folks, stay tuned. We're going to take a quick break, and then we're going to talk to a assemblyman in Nevada who introduced a bill for Medicaid for all. Not Medicare for all, Medicaid for all.
It's a summertime affair. Shock it.
It's a summertime affair in the atmosphere. I'm a lover, attire and the clothes that she wear. Some of them are bone up, them tires, some of them are draw down gear. Well, some of them are shine up, some are wax up, not a sign of smear. Gotta be rolling in my crystals that the girls them stare. This is Shaggy and Raven as your ultimate pair. Taking care of her career, so tell the world beware. Cause it's a brand new selection for your musical era. Caramel skin. I'm a smile at her, she looked at me and gave me a grin. I'm an offered her a drink and she said juice and gin. And as I whispered in her ear, I asked her, how you doing? Where was it that I resided? And I told her, Brooklyn. Atmosphere filled with romance, eyes were sparkling. Just her voice and what she said, I let my poor head spin. Ragamuffin, shaggy, now with a musical swing. I used a pretty little woman, sexy as skin. Be sweet as a honey sting like bumblebee. Shaggy, a pretty little woman, sexy as skin.
Welcome back to the show. I'm still Joshua Holland. I had a piece at The Nation this week titled Medicare for All Isn't the Solution for Universal Healthcare. That headline was a little more aggressive than the one that I proposed, but the basic gist is that while I'm a longtime advocate for single-payer healthcare, the challenges of putting everyone in one big program are really daunting. And while I think the politics of Medicare for All are really good, and we should call it that, we really need to be thinking of Medicare for all who are uninsured or who would prefer it to private coverage. And a key point that I made was that healthcare is really complicated and we shouldn't make a litmus test out of any one policy. We need to start with the broad principle that healthcare is a human right, and that's not access to an emergency room. Comprehensive healthcare is a human right. We need to get everyone covered and then figure out how best to get there. We also have to contain costs. Anyway, my next guest has offered a different approach to expanding coverage, which has some strong merits and some potential issues as well. Mike Sprinkle is a representative in the Nevada Assembly. He introduced a bill earlier this year that some call Sprinkle Care, and it would allow anyone in Nevada who isn't covered to buy into the state's Medicaid program. So some health wonks believe that Medicaid would be a better vehicle than Medicare for this type of approach. Assemblyman Sprinkle, welcome to Politics and Reality Radio.
Hey, thank you for having me. I'm real happy to talk about my bill and about healthcare as a whole.
Now, thank you for taking the time. The idea of a Medicare buy-in is not new. What are some of the advantages you see in letting people buy into Medicaid?
Yeah, so obviously we gave this a lot of thought about what program was going to work best, and many of the decisions that we made that led up to the bill that ultimately made it through our legislature and then was vetoed by our governor, was really looking at what specifically our state could do to protect its citizens. There's been so much kind of uncertainty coming out of the federal government that while, as you have rightly mentioned, there's been a lot of focus in the past about looking at Medicare, we really thought that as a state legislature, we had the most control, the most direct control over what we did with our Medicaid program. And so that was specifically why we focused and I focused on looking at Medicaid as an alternative to the private health industry here in the state of Nevada.
I should note that, as you said, Governor Sandoval vetoed the bill. And according to reports, you're going to reintroduce it next year. Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. Certainly the policy or the thought behind it, what that bill is actually going to look like, I'm still working on. I'm still going to be bringing people to the table. We only meet every 2 years, our legislative session. And so I've got a little bit of time to really dig into this and figure out what might have been some of the concerns. Well, I already kind of have an idea about what some of the concerns were, but certainly what would make this a viable option in the state of Nevada, and then what or how I want to move forward with the next piece of legislation.
Well, let's talk about the bill that got through the legislature. Excuse me, I don't speak English. For subsidies. Give us some more detail about how this would work.
Yeah, absolutely. And if you look at the bill, the language of the bill itself, it was only about 4 pages, and it was pretty broad, but actually that was the intent of the legislation, because then what we were going to do, the implementation date for whatever plan we came up with, wasn't going to be until January 1st of 2019. And we were really going to kind of sit down and hammer out those specific details that you just asked about. In general, I can say that the thought was anybody that did not currently or was not currently eligible for the Medicaid benefit that's offered right now would then have the option to buy in at a premium cost the basic benefit package that is Medicaid in the state of Nevada. It's not actually receiving Medicaid in the sense that you are paying for it. The person would be paying for it through a premium charge. But then they would be getting what many consider to be pretty good benefits that are based out of our Medicaid program. Obviously, the very next question that many people have asked is, well, what would that premium cost be? What we would be looking at is whatever the cost of those benefits were, plus maybe a 1 to 2% margin, which I can explain in a second, over and above that. Ultimately, down the road, we had even thrown the idea around about having different tiers or different levels, just like you see today with the exchanges, so that, you know, we might have a gold package or a bronze package. But right now, what we were hoping to accomplish was the basic Medicaid benefits that are offered in the state of Nevada at a premium cost.
But these would have been available through the Affordable Care Act exchange, is that right?
No, actually, that's incorrect. That was one of the problems that we ran into once we first started having these conversations, is that that would have been in violation of what is contained in the Affordable Care Act. What we would have needed to do and what we would have pursued doing had my bill been signed into statute was to attempt through CMS to get a waiver. With the new administration, we've been given a lot of indication that they were going to be far more liberal in giving out those waivers as long as the states were showing some type of initiative or new approach and were willing to take on some of the burden themselves, which this bill would have done. So we felt pretty confident that we would have been able to get a waiver, which then would have allowed us access to the exchanges. But as of right now, no, that would not have been allowed through the exchange, and which also then includes the incentives that go along with people buying in the exchange.
That is the subsidies for people who are making too much to be eligible for Medicaid benefits and up to 400% of the poverty line, right?
Exactly. Yeah.
Okay. So you want to? So you need the federal government to sign off on this, but potentially you could see it working that you would sell it through the exchanges. It would be effectively a public option for the people of Nevada, and it would be eligible for the Obamacare subsidies, right? I mean, the potential is there for that, right?
That was certainly the direction we were going to work towards. However, that was not. We weren't being dependent upon that. Had we not received those waivers, we still had a plan, or at least a conceptual plan, in place that would have allowed this to move forward in the state of Nevada, and we just would have, in essence, had to do the marketing on our own, which is something we talked about. One of the people that was part of my task force working on this was the head of our Medicaid division here in Nevada. And so we talked about how the application process and the marketing would simply be done through the Medicaid division, and we were okay with that. It just would have been far more reaching had we been able to receive those waivers and really get that on the exchange so that people knew about it.
And I should let listeners know that I'm talking to you about this program in Nevada, but I'm also thinking about it as it's potentially applicable to other states as a way to expand healthcare in general. Now, unlike Medicare, Medicaid is largely controlled by the states, as we've said, and I see that as a kind of double-edged sword and an advantage on the one hand, in that the federal government has lots of choke points that make it difficult to advance kind of, you know, big legislative changes. So you can see it being done in states that are politically more amenable to these types of things. But on the other hand, you know, while more forward-leaning states can emulate it, we are already living in kind of two countries, red states and blue states, when it comes to public services and the social safety net in general. So you see Medicaid eligibility and benefits already varied widely from state to state, as does spending on education and other social goods and unemployment and all of that stuff. So as far as a model for moving the country forward, this is a limitation. Mike, let me ask you a question. Medicare pays providers about 20% less than private insurers do, and then Medicaid on average pays about 66% of what Medicare pays. That's the nationwide average. I know in Nevada you guys pay about 81% of Medicare's rates. I don't think there's a serious risk of doctors like fleeing the Silver State en masse, as some conservatives predicted. But isn't there a legitimate question about whether enough physicians would take on new patients at these rates?
Oh, absolutely. And I think that that's a very, very much a part of the discussion that would have to continue to be had. Now, the flip side of that is, as we continue with the uncertainty that we're seeing out of the federal government and even the potential, keeping in mind that Nevada is one of those states where we have the expansion of our Medicaid population.
Right.
Should that expansion go away, should the mandates that are currently found in the Affordable Care Act, should those be taken out, all of a sudden these exact same providers who are concerned about the reimbursement rates, and again, rightly so, might be finding that there's an abundance of patients out there that are completely uninsured once again, which was a real concern and problem for the state of Nevada before the Affordable Care Act was put in place. What we're seeing right now already is some of the managed care organizations that do provide in the state of Nevada are already withdrawing either completely from the state, or just recently we have heard that at least some of the big providers are no longer going to be providing coverage to people in our rural counties, which makes up the majority of the state of Nevada. So either way, you're talking about no insurance and no reimbursement versus what could obviously be a less than ideal reimbursement rate, but still those providers are getting something. The one other thing to throw on top of all that is you're also going to potentially see a much greater volume of people with insurance, which then does also help those providers at least be receiving some sort of reimbursement for the services that they provide.
And do you see this as a kind of a model that could then be expanded to say small businesses? Could they then buy in for their employees?
That was absolutely part of the discussions that we had when we were putting the final bill language forward, was that the while initially we were focused on the individual who either was uninsured or unhappy with the current insurance that they had, the potential for a group rates or group plans through employers. One of the things we even talked about, we have a significant problem here in the state of Nevada with those that are incarcerated and us being able to afford to provide them the health insurance coverage that is required by the state to provide for those incarcerated people. Well, this was going to be a way to actually counter that, because now we could provide it through ourselves, in essence. So yeah, the potential and the possibilities were great. And I do think that in the future, they will be great if we can move forward with this concept and idea.
You know, I got to tell you, I have individual health insurance through the Obamacare market, and I am extremely grateful that it cost me about $350 less than it would every month without the law. But I hate my insurer. I would gladly buy into Medicaid if I could. And folks, there are studies that show that Medicaid recipients are about as satisfied with their insurance as are people who get their insurance through their employers, even though it costs significantly less. Let me ask you one more question before I go. Actually, I have two more. Do I have another 2 minutes with you?
Certainly, that's fine.
Okay. All right. So, first of all, one of the reasons that Sandoval said that he vetoed it is that there were too many uncertainties. Are you working on like actuarial analyses that would give us a better grasp on potential enrollment, pricing, et cetera, et cetera? Is that something that you're going to get together before you reintroduce this bill?
So one of the unfortunate things with the veto was, had the bill been signed into statute, we had been given a guarantee through our commissioner on insurance that he had over $1 million in grant funding that he would be able to put directly towards an actuarial study. So we were going to get those very specific numbers that are somewhat lacking right now in the language of the bill that did not move forward. So yes, that is a key component to all of this, how we do that and how we will fund the actuarial study. I will work on that in the future, and we need that study to be done, because that's vital to coming up with a plan that's going to make sense.
I wonder if the Kaiser Family Foundation would help you out with that. The final question that I have is, what kind of resistance from healthcare stakeholders did you get with this bill? And was there some that were in support?
So I got very little resistance, to be perfectly honest. Most people were either intrigued or had questions because they weren't quite sure exactly what it was that I was proposing. The only stakeholders that came forward in opposition when the bill was first heard in the assembly was the Hospital Association. And while they said that they were intrigued by the concept, they felt that specifically because of the reimbursement rates, that it would not be feasible for them. And so they came in opposition. I don't know what happened from the time that the bill went from the assembly to the Senate, but when it was heard in the Senate, they actually withdrew that opposition and came in neutral and said they just really wanted to see how we moved forward with the bill. That was the only formal opposition that anybody expressed to me throughout the entire process. As far as those that were in support, many people, including insurance companies that currently do not or are not allowed to provide in the state of Nevada, thought that this might be an opportunity for them, because while the concept was kind of based off of a single payer model, we did allow for our Medicaid division to enter into contractual agreements for the management of this plan with private insurers. And so even they were interested in what this was going to look at and how look like and how they might be able to benefit from it, as opposed to any kind of marketplace disruption, which might be harmful to the private insurance industry. So a lot of people at least expressed to me that they were intrigued, if not supportive of the concept.
Nevada Assemblyman Mike Sprinkle, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us. We're really intrigued by your proposal here.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. Thank you for having me on.
I'd also like to thank Stan Collender and Lindsay Beierstein. You can follow me on Twitter at Joshua Hall. You can subscribe to the show at iTunes or Podbean or wherever else you can find it. You can send an email griping to the show about the show to politicsandreality@gmail.com. I would also like to thank the good folks at Crooks and Liars, Smirking Chimp, and Hullabaloo for letting me park our show at their respective joints. And of course, I would like to thank all of you good people for tuning in. Have a good week and stay cool. Give me a soft, subtle mix. And if it ain't broke, then don't try to fix it. And think of the summers of the past. Adjust the bass and let the Alpine blast. Pop in my CD and let me run around and put your...